There was still plenty of time before going to bed, so I did what I always do when I get to a new hotel. I took everything out of my pockets, backpack and suitcase, so I could clean out and organize my stuff. I said to Karen, "There's only enough room on the bed for one of us to do this at a time, so I'm going first." She didn't even look up from her iPad. It was a good thing I cleaned and organized. I found the second coconut long boy. It melted in my backpack. Karen was right. There is a dark side to the coconut lifestyle. My flashlight, travel-sized roll of duct tape, spork, and reading glasses were all stuck together with a coconut goo ball at the center. It took all my wet wipes to clean the stickiness off everything. I told Karen, "I think sticky is my least favorite condition. I also don't like being damp." She looked up and said, "This is why we travel, to know ourselves better." Before turning in for the night, I went across the street to the drugstore for more wet wipes. Tomorrow is a big day. We're visiting two national parks. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, Number 35, Everglades National Park. Date, November 13, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, I'd wear cologne made of deep woods off if it existed. It's one of the few non-food smells I like, although it makes me lightheaded. Spraying it on my body has the same effect as drinking two Coors Lights. Karen wanted to go into the Everglades wearing her non-toxic bug spray made from lemon eucalyptus oil. Please. Once the mosquitoes found the white meat on the back of her thighs, she was begging for my off. This morning we drove to the Ernest F. Coe Visitor Center on the eastern edge of Everglades National Park to take care of our park's business and do some hiking. Next week, on our way back from Key West, we plan on spending more time in the park. The park is so large and diverse that today we only had a chance to see a small area of it. From the visitor center, we drove to the Long Pine Key trailhead and hiked for about an hour. Then we went to the Royal Palm Visitor Center and hiked the Anhinga and Gumbo Limbo trails. We saw lots of alligators on the Anhinga Trail and took some fantastic pictures. Seeing the wildlife made me wish that I'd bought a better camera for our park trip. The Gumbo Limbo Trail wound through the trees away from the swamp. We didn't see any wildlife, but saw plenty of Gumbo Limbo trees. I tried to find out why they are called Gumbo Limbo trees, but with no luck. I found a reference that the first use of the name dates back to the early 19th century. I'd like to believe there was a contest to come up with the dumbest name for the tree, and Gumbo and Limbo tied, so they settled on Gumbo Limbo. It's a prolific tree, though. Any twig taken from the tree and stuck into the ground will grow. Fence posts made from Gumbo Limbo wood have been known to sprout leaves and even turn into fully fledged trees. The entire time we were on the Anhinga and Gumbo Limbo hikes, we heard a loud noise like an engine. We thought there must be construction going on close by, but we didn't see any signs of it on our hikes. In the parking lot, we found the source of the noise. A tour bus parked with its engine and air conditioner running. There was no one in the bus. The air conditioner ran so when the tour group finished looking at the alligators, they would have a cool bus to come back to. Standing next to the bus, it sounded like an airplane taking off. The noise and the exhaust didn't exactly fit with the wilderness feel the Park Service is trying to create. It was an easy drive from where we were in the Everglades to the Biscayne National Park Visitor Center. We drove right past the Homestead Miami Speedway. I hadn't thought to look at the NASCAR calendar when planning our trip to these two parks. Or ever. Luck was with us, though. NASCAR is not in Homestead until next weekend. It would have been a huge pain, maybe impossible, to get through traffic if the race was this weekend. Our afternoon boat tour departed from the pier in front of the Biscayne Visitor Center. It was a pontoon-type scuba-diving boat with a Jimmy Buffett wannabe captain. The weather was good, the ocean was calm, and it was a very relaxing afternoon. At Boca Chica Key, we docked in the protected harbor. Large yachts occupied every slip except the one reserved for the Park Service. We had about an hour and a half to poke around the small key, which was enough time to see every inch of it two or three times. While exploring the key, we had a noise pollution flashback from this morning. There was very loud, very bad Julio Iglesias music coming from one of the large boats docked in the harbor. We could see the owner sitting on the back deck of his boat, with his shirt off, having a drink. Perhaps he thought he was doing us a favor by playing this music loud enough so we could all hear. Or maybe he was deaf and didn't know his stereo was on. Across the harbor, we climbed to the top of the ornamental lighthouse. We could hear Julio much better from the observation platform, then strolled through the campgrounds. Being a Saturday, it was packed with visitors. A man slept on an air mattress in the middle of the campground with his mouth open. Karen said he must have passed out, because no one would be able to sleep through the loud music. Birds were picking through his stuff. If he left any food out, it was surely gone by now. The boat ride back to the visitor center was as uneventful as the ride out. That's not a complaint. Uneventful is a good thing when crossing a large body of water in a pontoon boat. Tomorrow we will drive to Key West, and on Monday catch a tour boat to Dry Tortugas National Park. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, Key West. Date, November 14, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, today alone, I've seen more man boobs than anyone should see in a lifetime. No man over the age of 40 should wear a tank top, especially a loose-fitting tank top, ever, not even in Key West. Karen and I drove from Homestead to Key West today. The weather was perfect, so we sat outside at a pizza restaurant and watched the world walk by. The T-shirts on the passers-by fascinated me. I said to Karen, "I need a T-shirt that expresses my personality." "And what would that look like?" "It's black, of course, and on the front there's a wolf with eagle wings howling at the moon. The wolf is wearing sunglasses, even though it's midnight, and has a solid gold chain around his neck. There's a bullet hanging on the gold chain, and in the background the word Destiny is printed in Japanese letters." Looking around the restaurant, she could see that I borrowed those ideas from the T-shirts on customers sitting around us. She said, "You better keep your voice down or someone's going to beat you up." "No one gets beat up these days. They get shot." "Yeah, well, the bullet would probably miss you and hit me." "You're right. Let's change the subject to ponytails. I always thought that because I'm going bald, a ponytail..." Karen cut me off. "Going bald? Nice. Anyway, I always thought that because I'm going bald, a ponytail was no longer an option for me. But after seeing the guys down here, I think I might grow one."
"You'd have to dye it blonde to fit in."
"I could do that." After lunch, we walked through the main tourist district of Key West. A huge crowd gathered at the west end of town. They were watching a hydroplane race. Every few minutes, the boats would scream past the crowd lining the waterfront. Helicopters followed overhead, covering the race. It was a party atmosphere, and I began to get caught up in the island vibe. I stopped at a t-shirt kiosk and looked at tank tops. I particularly liked the one with a parrot dressed like a pirate printed on front. I was checking for my size when I noticed Karen staring at me in disbelief. I snapped out of it. We walked back to our hotel, which was 3 miles from the main part of town. On our way, we found the pier where we need to be tomorrow morning to catch our boat to Dry Tortugas National Park. It's always good to be prepared. When we reached our hotel, there was a large black chicken in the drive by the front entrance, the area where cars pull in to unload and valet. Shadowing the chicken were 6 tennis ball-sized chicks. The mother darted between passing cars. With a delayed response, the chicks followed. One was always far behind the others. I could see concern on Karen's face.
"They're going to get run over," she said.
I tried to explain that wild chickens avoiding cars was part of the natural process, and we should not interfere. What I was trying to avoid was sleeping with a room full of chickens tonight, which began to look like a real possibility. She settled for talking with the valet and getting his personal guarantee that nothing bad would happen to the chickens. For his sake, I hope there are still 6 little ones tomorrow morning. Your friend, Matt.
From Karen Smith. Subject, number 36, Dry Tortugas National Park. Date, November 15, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, it's a beautiful Monday in Margaritaville. This morning I woke Matt up by singing Come Monday, one of my favorite Jimmy Buffett songs. Matt cut me off, saying, "No singing," like he always does. I know he's not saying it because I'm a bad singer. He just doesn't like spontaneous outbursts of joy. He's also banned my bad dancing. Now I do it just to annoy him. Today was our boat tour to Fort Jefferson in Dry Tortugas National Park. 70 miles west of Key West, Dry Tortugas is a cluster of 7 islands composed of little else but coral reefs and sand. These islands sit on the edge of the main shipping channel between the Gulf of Mexico, the Western Caribbean, and the Atlantic Ocean. Last night, when I told Matt that the park is named Dry Tortugas because it is shaped like a tortuga, a deep-fried burrito, he seemed even more excited to see the park. You can imagine his disappointment this morning when he learned it's called Dry Tortugas because of the turtles that live there, and because there is no fresh water on the islands. Tortuga is the Spanish word for turtle, not deep-fried burrito. We boarded the Yankee Freedom 2 at 7:30 a.m. for an 8 o'clock a.m. departure. The boat ride to Fort Jefferson took just over 2 hours. As we approached the island, we could see the walls of Fort Jefferson rising up 50 feet. It was a spectacular sight. Surprisingly, the fort takes up almost the entire island, and a surrounding moat protects it from both invaders and the pounding surf. We disembarked, took our picture in front of the park sign, and found the gift store. Not original to the fort. After taking care of business, we took a short guided tour of the fort. It's an impressive sight. The U.S. government built Fort Jefferson to protect the lucrative shipping channel. It's one of the largest remaining 19th-century American masonry coastal forts. We didn't know before today that masonry coastal forts was a category of thing. Construction began in 1847 on Garden Key Island, and by 1860, the government had spent over $250,000, yet the fort was only half complete. It remained in Union control during the Civil War, even though Florida joined the Confederacy. Work continued during the Civil War, but stopped after the war ended. The fort was never completed due to several factors. The difficulty and cost of shipping workers and supplies, the weather and concerns that additional bricks and cannon would cause further settling and more structural problems. The fort also served as a military prison during the Civil War and up until 1874. We walked through the cell of its most famous prisoner, Dr. Samuel Mudd, the physician who set the broken leg of John Wilkes Booth. Dr. Mudd was convicted of conspiracy in the murder of President Lincoln. He was given a life sentence and sent to Dry Tortugas. Our tour guide told us that the phrase, "Your name is Mudd," came from Sam Mudd. That's how reviled he was. But he got his chance at redemption. When an epidemic of yellow fever spread through the fort and the prison's physician died from the disease, Dr. Mudd single-handedly cared for the ill prisoners. Because of his heroic actions, President Andrew Johnson pardoned him, and he was released from Fort Jefferson in 1869. When we walked around the outer moat wall, we could see where large sections of the fort's wall had collapsed into the moat. If nothing were done to save it, over time the entire fort would fall into the water. The Park Service has initiated a very expensive, multi-phase preservation project to stabilize Fort Jefferson by repairing the damage caused by the salt, heat, destructive weather, and water. To preserve the historic appearance of the walls, workers are using concrete made of local sand and coral, as in the original construction, and historic bricks that were salvaged during demolition. We boarded the boat for lunch, and then spent the rest of the afternoon sitting on the small beach, enjoying the sun and the turquoise water. Some of the other passengers snorkeled. Earlier, the captain told us that the boat would leave for Key West at 3 o'clock p.m. sharp, and that he wasn't allowed to alert us by blowing the ship's horn because he was in a national park. Apparently, in the Everglades, you can let a big-ass tour bus sit empty in a parking lot and run its engine, which can be heard a half mile away, and in Biscayne, you can play bad music as loud as you want, but in Dry Tortugas, you can't alert visitors that the ship is leaving by sounding its horn. After we got back to the hotel, we walked the 3 miles to the main tourist area for dinner. We had a couple of cheeseburgers in paradise and some Margaritaville margaritas. Walking back home along the main drag, we stopped in front of a pet store window to watch 4 adorable puppies play with one another. They each had chomped down on a leg of a small stuffed rabbit and were locked in a tug of war. I couldn't look away. We stood there watching them for a half hour as crowds of partiers, drinks in hand, jostled by us. I guess that makes us officially old. Finally, Matt broke my trance by pulling me along the sidewalk toward our hotel. "It's been a long day, and we'll sleep well tonight." Your friend, Karen. From Karen Smith. Subject: Everglades Again. Date: November 16, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, today we left Key West and headed to Naples, where we're staying with Matt's parents for a few days. On our way across Highway 41, we stopped at Shark Valley in the north section of Everglades National Park. Shark Valley has a visitor center, a few short trails, and a narrated tram tour that follows a 15-mile paved path through the park. We planned to do the 2-hour tram ride, but once Matt got a look at the tourists crowding onto the tram, he suddenly decided it would be fun to ride bikes on the path in 90-degree heat instead. I wasn't crazy about the idea because it was very humid and it didn't look like there would be any shade on the trail. There wasn't. As Matt started filling out the bike rental paperwork, the guy behind the desk looked me up and down and then shook his head. Riding bikes on the path is hard work. You really should consider taking the tram. Excuse me? I looked at him in amazement. This guy has never laid eyes on me before, yet he somehow knew Matt's foolproof way to get me to do something I don't want to do. Tell me that I can't do it. Or bribe me with beer. It took me years to figure out how to get Matt to do something he didn't want to do, like hanging Christmas lights or cleaning out the garage. It's simple. I attempt to do it myself. He watches me for about 5 minutes, and then he says I'm doing it wrong and takes over. It works every time. So, of course, we rented bikes. I even took the one with the wobbly handlebars. We started out on the loop riding counterclockwise in the opposite direction of the tram. It didn't take long to forget about the heat and humidity and the insulting bike rental man. I was too busy being amazed by how beautiful the Everglades were. Shark Valley is in the heart of the true Everglades, or river of grass that stretches 100 miles from Lake Okeechobee to the Gulf of Mexico. About halfway around the loop, we stopped and climbed the 65-foot observation tower, which provides an outstanding view of this sawgrass prairie. We rode by dozens of alligators lying next to the trail. Most of them appeared to be asleep. Matt freaked out each time I rode within 2 feet of the edge of the path, yelling that an alligator was going to reach up and grab me. His concern was touching. He said, "If you lose a leg in there, I'm the one who has to go in after it and pedal it back to the visitor center to put it on ice." It was unclear in this scenario how I would get back with only one leg and a bleeding stump. Maybe on the tram, although I didn't have a ticket. Besides alligators, we saw lots of birds. And even though we're not terribly interested in birds, these were spectacular. Tall, long legs, beautiful feathers, prehistoric looking. After we returned our bikes to the bike rental guy, I jogged back to the car. I wanted to finish strong, just to show him who he was dealing with. However, my butt was numb, the muscles in my thighs were seizing up, and my purse kept slapping crazily against my hip. I'm pretty sure I looked like someone who should have taken the tram. We drove to Naples and arrived in time to go out for dinner with Matt's parents. Before we could leave their house, we waited while his mom got out pots and pans and spoons and loudly pretended to cook dinner as their little dog sat at her feet and watched. The dog won't eat her dinner until she sees that everyone else is eating dinner. On nights they go out, Matt's mom has to fake cook dinner so the dog will eat. Matt said to her, "You don't need to pretend that you're making dinner. The dog will eat when she gets hungry enough." His mom looked concerned. "Oh, I couldn't let her go hungry." The dog looked up from her food and started to bark. I think she was asking for dessert. Matt left the room and reappeared clutching a bottle of Boodle's gin he found in their liquor cabinet. "I hope there's enough to last 2 more days." Your friend, Karen.
From Matt Smith. Subject, Travel Day, to American Samoa. Date, December 2, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, tonight Karen and I are in American Samoa, the only part of the United States south of the equator. Among the many reasons I've been looking forward to being here is to see if it's true that toilets south of the equator swirl in the opposite direction of toilets north of the equator. I meant to test this theory on the plane from Honolulu. I was going to flush the airplane's toilet just as we were crossing over the equator, but I fell asleep and missed my chance. That makes me wonder, which directions do toilets swirl that are right on the equator? Is it a swirlless, chaotic swoosh? Anyway, as I stood over the toilet tonight in our hotel room, watching the water drain from the bowl, I realized I hadn't a clue which direction our toilets swirl at home. For a moment, I felt like I was starring in my own version of Dumb and Dumber. It's a good thing that's not the only reason we made this long trip. We left Issaquah at 5:40 a.m. this morning and arrived at our hotel in Pago Pago, the largest town in American Samoa, at 11 p.m. local time. To get here, we took a nonstop flight from Seattle to Honolulu, and after a 4-hour layover, took a nonstop flight to American Samoa. All our travel went as planned, but it was a long day. With the 3-hour time difference between here and Seattle, it ended up being about a 20-hour trip. The flight choices to American Samoa are very limited. There's a Hawaiian Airlines flight to and from Honolulu every Thursday and Sunday. That's it. 2 flights in, 2 flights out each week. We're taking the Sunday flight back to Honolulu at the end of this week. The Pago Pago International Airport was crowded when we arrived. It seemed as if the entire island came to greet the plane. The airport's main concourse is not very large and is open to the outdoors. A single large flat-screen TV hung on the wall in front of rows of chairs and benches. The locals were watching ESPN Sports Center and waiting for their family and friends to exit the plane. Just below the TV was the rental car window. I felt self-conscious enough wearing my Seattle-appropriate winter clothes in the South Pacific, but added to that I had to walk to the front of the crowd, stick my head in the car rental window, and holler to get the attendant's attention. He told me to stay right where I was, and he would bring me the keys and show me where the car was parked. I turned around to see what I imagined at the time was the entire island looking at me. They were actually looking at the TV, a couple of feet above my head, but it felt like they were looking at me. Karen was hiding in the back of the crowd. I waved for her to come stand next to me for no other reason than I wanted her to feel the same embarrassment I was feeling. She just looked away and slowly walked in circles around our bags with her arms folded. I was on my own. We've rented a car so we can drive around the island and see as much as possible while we're here. Driving from the airport to our hotel, I wasn't completely sure where I was going. I didn't even know which side of the road to drive on. I felt unprepared. I hate that feeling. We waited a few minutes until another car drove by to make sure. They drive on the right side of the road. The streets were dark and the inside of the windshield quickly fogged because of the humidity. I knew if I found the main road along the water and headed east, I'd be fine. It goes right past our hotel. I circled the airport a couple of times, making the same wrong turn on each pass, but eventually I found the main road and started heading in the direction of Pago Pago Harbor. Sadie's by the Sea, one of the few hotels on the island, will be our home until Sunday, when we fly back to Hawaii to visit the 2 national parks there. Too tired to tell you more. Must sleep now. Your friend Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject: Number 37, National Park of American Samoa. Date, December 3rd, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, this morning I was happy to see CNN on the flat-screen TV in Sadie's restaurant. It was like a window to our world back home. We ate breakfast outside on the patio. It was sunny and in the 70s. The forecast today was for scattered showers and 80 degrees. We asked the woman who brought us coffee if the weather was always like this. She said, "Well, it's hotter in the summer, January, you know, like 82, and in the winter, July, it's cooler. The highs might be 78. So somewhere between 78 and 82 degrees year-round?" I asked. "Yeah, that's about right. But December is when we get the most rain." We knew this was their rainy season, but December was the best time for us to come, given our other park trips. If we get wet, well, we've been wet before. I hope Karen's diaper rash doesn't come back. We're spending all our time here on the island of Tutuila, the largest of the six islands that make up American Samoa. Tutuila is about 5 miles at its widest point and about 20 miles long. The island is mostly mountainous. A majority of the 55,000 residents live at lower elevations close to the water, but there are villages in the mountains. Two-thirds of the jobs in American Samoa are related to either government or the tuna packing plant. There's not much industry here and very few tourists. This morning it took a couple of tries to find the park visitor center. We first went to the address for the original visitor center, which was a mile down the road from our hotel. But the entire building, which looked like it once housed several businesses as well as the visitor center, was closed. The 2009 tsunami damaged it severely. On September 29, 2009, an 8.1 magnitude earthquake, 120 miles offshore, caused a tsunami that slammed into the island and killed 31 people. There were places where the water from the tsunami went a mile inland. Some of the buildings along the water, including the one the visitor center was in, have not been repaired. They might never be repaired. The new visitor center is in a small strip of offices about 7 miles southwest of our hotel. Just inside the entrance of this makeshift visitor center was a wall partition with a folding table in front of it. The partition had a few maps taped to it, and on the table sat a sign-in register and the passport stamp. Karen and I stamped our passports and poked our heads around the partition to see if there was a ranger available. A young woman ranger came out and greeted us. She was very helpful with suggestions about hikes and other tips for seeing the island. She's been a ranger at this park for 2 years, and has been a ranger at 7 other national parks, most recently Yellowstone. We swapped park stories about Yellowstone, and told her about how we were visiting all the parks, and that we were planning on snowmobiling in Yellowstone in a couple of months. It was a good thing we found her. She gave us important information about the island and the park that we probably would have learned the hard way if we hadn't talked with her. She told us that if we wanted to go to the island of Tau, the southern half of Tau is part of the national park, we would have to take a private boat from Tutuila. She said those boats are not Coast Guard approved, many don't have life jackets, and we would have to appraise the situation ourselves to decide if we wanted to take the risk of riding in them. She also told us to be prepared in case the boat doesn't come back for us at the agreed-upon time. I whispered to myself, "Doesn't come back for us?" When we told her we had a rental car, she said, "Then you should drive to some of the villages. The people are very friendly and welcoming to visitors. There's very little crime on the island, but watch out for the roaming dogs. They can be aggressive toward people they don't know, and they're biters." I did not like the sound of that. From the visitor center, we drove into the mountains. We were anxious to see the park and go for a short hike. We also wanted to find the park sign so we could take our picture in front of it. On the north side of the island, we found a pullout along the road with National Park interpretive signs. The signs indicated that there was a hike from there to Craggy Point, a cliff overlooking the ocean, less than a mile away. At the far end of the trail, it detoured to a clearing with views of Pola Island, a dramatic rock outcropping separated from Tutuila by less than 100 yards of ocean. Also along the trail we could see the village of Vatia. The village was below us on the water in a protected bay. We decided to drive to the village and take a look around. On the way to Vatia, I spotted an official National Park sign. Graffiti was scratched onto its surface, but the sign was still legible. I thought it might be the only park sign we would find, so we stopped the car and took our picture. The sign read, Paka o America Samoa. We're a long way from the rest of America, and it feels like it. A few miles down the mountain, and we were in the village. The setting was beautiful, but the homes looked run down. There were few people about, only a handful of small children playing outside. Every house seemed to have a dog sleeping in the yard. All the dogs on this island look like they're related. They probably are. A couple of them barked at us and chased our car. They had vicious barks, not come-throw-my-ball-for-me barks. I wasn't going to get out and stroll through the village with barkers and biters everywhere. It was just before noon, and the sky was darkening. Rain was coming. We canceled our plans to hike and drove around the island, seeing it from the car. The sign next to one of the few strip malls on the island pointed to Shane J. Filipino Fast Food. At Shane J.'s, we sat under an awning out of the rain. At a small table with a red-and-white checkered plastic tablecloth, we ate peppered beef and barbecue pork sticks over rice for lunch. The woman who served us kept calling Karen Mommy. "What you have, Mommy? You have Pepsi, too, Mommy?" I said to Karen, "She thinks you're my mom."
"She doesn't think I'm your mom. It's a universal sign of respect, like when someone refers to the Queen as Mum."
"Are you saying she thinks you're the Queen?"
"No, I'm saying you're an idiot."
After our lunch, we went back to Sadie's and napped for a couple of hours. In the early evening, the rain stopped, and it was pleasant outside. We sat outside at Sadie's bar until dusk and drank a glass of wine. Sitting there, I heard a crunch like an apple being eaten, but it sounded as if it was coming from above us. It was. There was a bat in the tree above the patio eating some kind of fruit. I could hear it chewing. The fruit bats here are the size of dogs. They're called flying foxes. They can grow to have wingspans of 36 inches or more. That's a big bat. I'd like to see 2 million bats that size fly out of a cave. Today we were a bit jet-lagged. Hopefully tomorrow we will have our energy back, and the weather will be clear. We're planning on going for a long hike in the park. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject: American Samoa Continued. Date: December 4th, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, a kitten pawed a wine cork at our feet as we ate breakfast on the patio this morning. Karen put her hand down to get the kitten's attention with no luck, so she tossed a piece of bagel in its direction. She said, "I'd like to take this one home with us. I'll just put it in my suitcase. No one would ever know." If I had a nickel for every time I heard that. The rain cleared out overnight. While sitting at breakfast, it looked as if it would be a good day for a hike. Mount Alava Trail follows the ridgeline of the mountains to the north above Pago Pago Harbor. It marks the south boundary of the national park. That would be our hike for the day. At Fagasa Pass, we parked our rental car by the trailhead. Clouds were forming, and we felt a few raindrops. We weren't going to turn back because of rain. We only had a couple of days to see the island, and we were hiking today no matter what. The trail cut a path through the jungle, and the thick trees shaded us for the first couple of miles. As we got closer to the peak, the clouds cleared and there were open areas on the trail where we were in direct sunlight. We sweated like soaker hoses. In one of the clearings, we saw a strange tree just a few feet from the trail. It had what looked like an unopened flower bud the size of a football hanging down about 10 feet off the ground. Bright green shoots grew out of the stalk about a foot above the flower bud. Later we learned this was a banana tree. The green shoots were new bananas. The banana tree flower initially shoots up, but its weight eventually causes the flower stalk to bend toward the ground. By the time the bananas grow out of the flower stalk, it's upside down, and the bananas grow toward the sun. There was an old communications tower at the trail's peak. From the base of the tower, there was a panoramic view of Pago Pago Harbor on one side and the north shore of the island on the other, all 1,500 feet below. There we were, standing in the jungle on top of a mountain ridge in the South Pacific, with incredible views of the ocean, islands, villages, and the unusual vegetation around us. This is one of the great things about our parks trip. It's taken us to places we would never have thought to go otherwise. It felt good to have already hiked 7 miles while the day was still young. Back at the car, we noticed another park sign. This one was in better shape than the one from yesterday, so we took our picture in front of it. Now we have a couple to choose from when we make the photo album of our trip. There aren't many dining choices on the island, so we went back to Sadie's for lunch after the hike. The same waiter who served us breakfast was our server for lunch. He was a nice kid. He looked to be about 20 years old. Karen asked him, "Do you like living here?" He said, "Oh, yeah, I wouldn't want to live anywhere else." "Have you ever been to the mainland of the United States?" "No, I don't want to go there." "Why not?" "It scares me. I heard that there are a lot of shootings there. I'm afraid I'll get shot." "There is very little crime here. No one has a gun." Karen said, "It's not as bad as you think. Or at least it's not something that should keep you from visiting." He said, "I've also heard that everyone smokes, even little kids." "That's also an exaggeration. People smoke, but not little kids. I've never seen little kids smoking." "Well, that's what people here believe." American Samoa may be far from the rest of the United States, but they seem very proud to be Americans. There is an Army Reserve unit and an Army recruiting office on the island. Even some of the graffiti on the concrete barriers along the road has a patriotic theme. One read, "Happy 110 years, American Samoa." An American flag was painted next to those words. While we ate lunch, we could see the hotel staff preparing tables for a large party. We asked our waiter about the event. He said, "The Army Reserve Unit is putting on their Christmas party here tonight." I asked the waiter, "Are many of the residents on the island in the military?" He said, "Some people who live here are in the reserve unit, but when young people go into the military, they usually don't come back until they're finished with their service or retire. There are a lot of people on the island who are retired from the military." He explained, "There aren't many jobs on the island, so after high school they go into the military as a career, and when they retire they come back and live very well on their military pension. Yeah, the people you see driving new cars on the island are mostly retired military. They come back, build a nice house for their entire family, buy a new car, and live pretty well for little money." It turned out to be a perfect afternoon to drive and see the island. From our hotel, we drove on Highway 001 toward the east end of the island. The road was near the ocean the entire way and in pretty good shape. We averaged about 30 miles per hour on the long, twisting road. On the other side of Pago Pago Harbor from our hotel is a tuna packing plant. There used to be two major companies with tuna packing plants on the island, but one of them closed and left many people out of work. The remaining plant is responsible for creating about a third of the jobs on the island. Beyond the tuna plant, we drove through village after village. Many times we saw signs for villages, but saw no more than two or three houses close together. Each village has a chief and a falatele, or big house. A big house is an open-air pavilion, usually with a thatched roof, where villagers hold community and family gatherings. The chief also holds his council meetings there. Every big house was unique. Some were elaborate and well cared for, with paved parking areas in front. Others were small and looked like a strong wind would knock them over. Most of the big houses we saw today were empty, except for a dog or two napping in the shade of the roof. The farther east we went on the island, the fewer homes we saw. The views were iconic South Pacific: white sand beaches, palm trees, and a blue-on-blue horizon. Now and then we saw groups of kids, in a wide range of ages, all playing together in the shallow water. What a great place for a kid to grow up! The one place my research assistant said we absolutely must visit on the island was Tisa's Barefoot Bar. It's located at Alega Beach on the east end of Tutuila Island. Everyone calls it Tisa's. Tisa has a home on the beach and built a hut next to it so she can serve food and drinks to the few tourists and visitors who make it to her end of the island. It took us a couple of passes, but we finally found it. Tisa's is as authentic as a beach bar could be. She built it, at least partially, with stuff that washed up on her beach. Karen and I sat on the deck outside overlooking the ocean and drank a beer. We didn't want to leave. The only other customers were two women from Washington, D.C., who work for the federal government and were here on business. They came to Tisa's on their day off while waiting for the Sunday flight back to Honolulu. 2 hours at Tisa's and we were thoroughly relaxed. We drove back to our hotel, cleaned up, and went to Sadie's sister hotel down the street for dinner, the Sadie Thompson Inn. We were lucky to have good weather today. We're still feeling jet-lagged from Thursday, so we're going to bed early. Tomorrow we start our trek back to Hawaii. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject: Travel Day to Hilo. Date: December 6, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, by the time we made it to the patio for breakfast yesterday, the Sunday NFL games were on TV. With the time difference, the games come on earlier than on the mainland. Football is popular in American Samoa. There are more college and NFL football players from American Samoa per capita than from anywhere else in the United States. The Army Reserve Unit's Christmas party from the night before went late. I could hear the music past 1 a.m. The staff had already cleaned the patio area, but some of the trash ended up in the harbor. The wind must have blown a trash can into the water during the night. After breakfast, I sat on the hotel's small beach looking at the harbor. I had no motivation to pack. Instead, I watched the debris slowly wash onto the beach. I'd choose a piece of trash in the harbor and root for it to make it to shore. It would wash up and stay for a moment, but the next wave would take it back out. Finally, it would land high enough on the beach to stay for good. Then I'd choose another piece and root for it. I gave up on the styrofoam cup after its many weak efforts, and instead rooted for the plastic Sprite bottle. "If the coconut can make it, so can you," I encouraged the Sprite bottle. Not out loud, of course. Karen came out to the beach and said, "It's getting late. You should come in and start getting ready to leave." I replied, "As soon as the Sprite bottle makes it ashore, I'll take a shower and pack." Our flight to Honolulu was scheduled to leave at 11:20 p.m. That gave us all day to fill with odds and ends. We checked out of the hotel and looked at each other with the same, "What do you want to do for the next 10 hours?" expression. One thing was for sure, we needed to do laundry. Everything I owned smelled like the island, and not in a pleasant tropical fruit coconut way. A mile from the hotel was a laundromat. It was about noon when we realized we'd joined an American Samoa Sunday after church tradition, laundry day. Just after we loaded our washing machine, a horde of families arrived, each with what looked like at least a week's worth of laundry. Everyone was pleasant with us, but we got more than a few strange looks. I think we used someone's regular machine, setting their Sunday plans back an hour. With our laundry done, there were only 7 or 8 hours left to kill. I don't kill time well. We decided to drive the entire length of the island from west to east. Starting from the middle of the island, we drove first to the far west end. It was interesting to see the entire island. There seemed to be more churches than the population could support. Many were elaborately decorated for Christmas. One had 21 plastic Santas on its facade. I took a picture of it and counted them. After our drive, there were still hours to spare, so we went back to Tisa's. She wasn't surprised to see us again, even though we said our goodbyes the day before. We're not the first people to kill time at Tisa's waiting for the 11:20 p.m. Sunday flight. She said, "Let me fix you dinner." The smells coming from her kitchen made it impossible to refuse her offer. Her son-in-law fixed us huge steaks with grilled bananas on the side, which he cut from a bunch hanging by the bar. He told us that he spent 8 years cultivating this type of banana, called King's Bananas. His original plants came from the Manua Islands, just east of Tutuila. They're the only kind of banana that grow right side up. His story fascinated me, and I believed it completely. But Karen wasn't so sure. She said she found a Chiquita sticker on her plate. Either way, they were fantastic. Tisa sat and talked with us for a couple of hours, telling us about the American Samoa culture, both the good and the bad. After our early dinner, she encouraged us to walk along the beach in front of her house, bar, restaurant. She told us that the beaches are the property of the villages, and visitors should ask permission before using them. The water was very clear, and not more than knee-deep for a long distance from shore. Brightly colored fish swam around our legs. It was like snorkeling with our heads above the water. After more goodbyes, we were off to the airport for a very early check-in. We returned our rental car at 7:30 p.m. I thought this was ridiculously early until I saw the check-in line. It was at least 100 people deep. I could tell as soon as we got in line that something wasn't right. A Hawaiian Airlines agent came on the public address system and said, in a tone that sounded like she was making a routine announcement, that our flight was being delayed until 5 a.m. She added, "So everyone should just come back about 3:30 a.m. Did I mention I don't kill time well? We got our rental car back. No charge, thank you, Avis. And Hawaiian Airlines paid for an extra night at Sadie's. We drove back to our hotel and napped in our clothes until 2 a.m. From that point forward, everything went smoothly. At least I think it did. I was delirious for most of it. When we got to Honolulu, we caught a quick flight to Hilo, where we're staying for 2 nights. Tomorrow we're visiting Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, and maybe a nut factory. Your friend, Matt.
From Karen Smith. Subject, number 38. Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. Date, December 7, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, this morning, when I reached into the bottom of my suitcase and pulled out a pair of shorts, there was a melted peppermint patty stuck to the butt. It's really sweet of Matt to hide these in my suitcase and surprise me, but I wish he would double bag them. Now I have a brown stain, surprise, on the back side of my shorts in the worst possible place for a brown stain to be. I've been looking forward to this day for a long time. The images I've seen of Hawaii Volcanoes National Park are spectacular. Fiery, molten lava sputtering, oozing, and flowing from Kilauea. In addition to Kilauea, one of the world's most active volcanoes, the park has another volcano, Mauna Loa, the world's most massive. Here are some fun facts I read about Kilauea. The word Kilauea means spewing or much spreading in Hawaiian. It has erupted 35 times since 1952, not including the current episode. The volume of erupted material is large enough to pave a road around the world 3 times. Millions of tourists visit Kilauea each year, making it the most visited attraction in Hawaii and the most visited volcano in the world. The USGS considers Kilauea the most dangerous volcano in the U.S. After all this hype and anticipation, when we got to the park, the volcano was just sitting there doing nothing. At the Kilauea Visitor Center, a message on the wall said that no lava was flowing today. We had assumed lava was always flowing. Thinking this must be a mistake, we asked a park ranger if this were true. She said, "No lava flowing anywhere in the park." There's a hotline to call to find out where lava is flowing, so I called it just to make sure. I called every 2 hours for the rest of the day, just in case it started flowing again. No luck. As Matt put it, we got a dud day. We hiked along the Crater Rim Trail and the Kilauea Iki Trail, 4 miles round trip. Not what you'd call a pretty hike. It was mostly gray scorched rock with very little vegetation. As we got to the middle of the crater, we heard a voice talking very loudly and couldn't figure out where it was coming from. I thought it might be Pele, the volcano goddess who lives there. Then we passed a woman, a mere mortal, sitting on a rock by the trail talking on her cell phone. She was conducting a conference call right beside the trail. Nice. Matt goes into a tailspin every time he sees someone talking on a cell phone in a national park wilderness area. We stopped while he took pictures of her. He also took a short video clip if you'd like to see the call in action. Images and stories of Pele are prominent throughout the park. Apparently, she lives in the craters of the Kilauea volcano and sends ribbons of fiery lava down the mountainside. Today must have been her day off. Legend has it that Pele puts a curse on anyone who steals from her home. Each year, guilty people from all over the world mail thousands of lava rocks back to the park, claiming to have had terrible things happen to them since taking the rocks from Pele's home. If every park has a god or goddess watching over it, then it's a good thing I didn't take the penis driftwood from Olympic National Park. After lunch, we drove the Chain of Craters Road. It descends 3,700 feet in 20 miles and ends at the coast where a 2003 lava flow crossed the road. We parked along the road and hiked to the Pu'uloa petroglyphs, one of the best and largest petroglyph fields on the Big Island. It was 1.4 miles round trip. This particular field has over 15,000 petroglyphs, which have been scratched or pecked into the hard Pahohoe lava surface.